Welcome to the Gary Gallaher Law Hour. Attorney Gary Gallaher and his firm have represented thousands of Hawaii workers and families during more than 35 years' practice throughout the islands. Whether helping countless workers exposed to asbestos unknowingly in their jobs, filing suit against gas companies for unfair local pricing, or representing the state of Hawaii and winning a settlement against Big Tobacco, the Gallaher Law Firm helps fight for consumer advocacy and fair play for the people of Hawaii. No kopono on your behalf. Now, Gary and his team are here to take the mystery out of what they do and answer your legal questions. So here's the host of our show, Mike Buck, and Hawaii attorney, Gary Gallaher.
Well, hello and welcome. Today's going to be sort of a how you doing day, and it's nice to get to know you day. And it's kind of interesting because, number one, I'm really honored to be hosting and facilitating the show for Gary. Gary Gallaher and I have known each other for decades, and I remember when he first became a lawyer, I said, wow, this guy's a lawyer already. He's somebody. And we sort of lost touch with each other. We were both ocean lovers for a long time. And, you know, what happens here in Hawaii, Gary, what goes around comes around. And what goes around certainly has come around in this thing. And I'm really stoked to be here introducing you to our audience. How you doing?
Good. It's nice to be here, Mike.
You know, everybody has heard of your firm. You've been high profile for a long time. But none of that comes easy. I'm kind of interested as maybe some of the building block basics. What brought Gary Gallaher to Hawaii, and more importantly, what turned Gary Gallaher into this attorney that you are today?
Well, you know, back when I first met you, Mike, you were the high makamaka. You were the one that had the big boat. You know, I was the one building boats and working on boats and diving commercially. I went to UCLA, and I came to Hawaii in the summer of 1966 for the noble purpose of surfing.
Yep.
I worked in Lahaina. I worked as a waiter at the Pioneer Inn, slept in the back of surf shops. But long and short of it is, by the end of summer, I said, why would I ever leave here?
Yeah.
And so that's kind of how I started.
We got you. That's when I met you, right, in the very beginning.
Well, it was pretty. It was Skin Diving Hawaii, I think, is where we met. Jose Angel and I were building a boat down there, the Anella, and Sally Noxon had the Skin Diving Hawaii shop, and we had mutual friends and acquaintances there. That's when I first recalled you.
What's interesting to me is that cadre of friends is still a cadre of friends, and I've had, like you, over the years, tens if not thousands of people that you get acquainted with, but you can always go back to that particular group and talk like nothing ever, no time has transpired. Okay, now, however, though, you know, you know, from becoming a surfer that was justifying his surfing habit by working, you became a worker that, what the heck do you do for fun? You are like working all the time.
No, I love what I do, Mike. I really, really been fortunate and lucky to represent the people I have. You know, back in the early days, I lived on the North Shore, and surfing was my life, and I taught special education at Haliva. And in the summer times, a dive would chase a lua and dive commercially. Back then, turtles were legal, and we would sell turtle steak at the CVU Inn. And there was a shortage of special ed teachers and math teachers back then, and I got a fellowship to get a special ed credential. I graduated in psychology from UCLA,
and Gary, then I went to school. What drives people to help special need individuals? I mean, that's a very tough road for you to choose.
Well, you know, I kind of had a missionary feeling about me. My mom had been a special ed teacher on the mainland, or an aide, actually. She didn't have a formal education. I was the first one on my mom's side to actually go to college. And so I had a compassionate side to me. I wanted to help and give back, if you will.
What do you think contributed, first of all, being on that side of the street that you were on as a youth, and then making yourself? Has that, you think, given you a pretty good grasp on what common folks go through when something goes wrong?
You know, I thought I would define myself as getting rich if I could get somebody else to work on my car. My $75 Volkswagen I could fix. I learned how to do all that stuff. And, no, it was just naturally. Tony Chiavi was a good friend. Jose Angel was a good friend. And I worked with my hands. Yep. And I felt very comfortable working with my hands. I worked as a carpenter for Harita while I was waiting to go back to school. So That's who I identify with.
You know, when I first heard about what you were doing, high profile, when I first came back and started working more regularly here on Oahu, that you, the big thing that you were doing was this asbestos work and work in an area which was people maybe like what you kind of did at one time, work with your hands. But these are people that work with this material for a long time. And quite honestly, I don't know if most people, the big bad companies, I don't think they knew really how big and how bad some of these companies were and how bad some of these things are. Didn't they say, oh, Galler, that's the guy that chases ambulances. He just wants to go sue somebody.
No, it was a little bit different than that. I worked with Walter Kiramitsu in Wahiawa, and then with Shem Siegel, Tam and Naito downtown in Honolulu. John Wahe was in that firm back then. And I was a low mat on the totem pole, and the first asbestos case came in. The firm represented lots of labor unions, Alvin Shem and Ben Siegel, and Ray Tam, Walter Kiramitsu, myself, we represented the guys got hurt, mm-hmm. and the unions referred mm-hmm. them in. The first guy came in, Tristan Nobrega, had mesothelioma, so I did the medical research, the Medline. But I had a head start at law school, William Richardson. Dick Miller, our torts professor, made a case study of asbestos and the history of it, so I knew something about it. And I did all of that research, and once I had done the research and the investigation, I just really felt sorry mm-hmm. for the people. And were sick, and because asbestos, when you look at it, it's like harmless. It doesn't look like anything exciting. It's like a mechanic in Greece, yeah, it's part of
yeah,
the deal.
Part of the deal, right? Yeah.
Shipyards or wherever. And so I learned about it, and then once I did the investigation, I found out there were like 30 different companies that supplied asbestos to Pearl Harbor, and they had a duty to warn, but they didn't. And once I did the research and homework, the big original companies, they were really dirty. They knew about the hazards, and they just never told anybody.
You know, what I think is interesting, and I think that our audience and anybody needs to know this, is that when something first comes up that looks like it would need your firm's, you know, expertise and things, I guess determining on who the real person at fault is the trick. And in other words, the shipyard, you want to say, well, I want to blame my boss. It's a shipyard. What was the shipyard not told by the people that made the materials that they bought? Was there liability with them too?
No, they could have done a better job. But the truth of the matter is the manufacturers were the experts. Mm-hmm. The Johns Manvilles, the Rebestos Manhattans, those companies in the 20s and the 30s, Manville had a vertical monopoly.
Yeah. Wow.
They mined, they milled, and manufactured. And back then, there was another scourge called silicosis. And both of asbestosis and silicosis are related. They're scarring of the lungs. But the old scourge, silicosis, was really bad because it predisposed people to get tuberculosis. Well, people were getting sick, and then the workers were suing back there in the 20s or starting. And so those companies did research, not out of the goodness of their heart, but to defend the cases.
I bet they were scared to death. What are we going to do here?
They wanted to make sure it wouldn't predispose to get tuberculosis. So they experimented on all the little animals at the Saranac Laboratories in New York. And lo and behold, all the animals got sick. But the good news was they didn't get silicosis, but predisposed to, they got asbestosis, but it didn't predispose to get tuberculosis. Mm-hmm. So that was the good news. The bad news was they had this other thing. The longer they exposed them, they started to develop cancer.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they didn't tell anybody. The company buried that research. They said this could be dynamite if this word got out. Yeah, so they buried all that. In the meantime, they let their workers just work in the dust.
Okay,
tragic.
You know what? I really want to return to that, but I want people to know that in some respects, what endeared you to the state of Hawaii was, did you use the same approach when you chose and the state chose to work with you over the tobacco settlement, which affects lots and lots of people. I mean, everybody smoked. I don't know if it was a fair settlement, but I know that you were victorious, and it proved the point that we're still living with the results of that work today. How much of the work that you had pre-done as a smaller firm helped you in that particular fight to really fight big tobacco?
Well, we had been working on that behind the scenes for 20 years, 15 years, but it was just an impossible battle on an individual case. But we had done a lot of homework, and the tobacco companies were just downright evil. They designed their product to be more addictive.
Mm,
they put
when guilty as charged over here. I mean, guilty. No. I did it for a year.
And people really underestimate how addictive it is. But when you find out the history, when the cancer scare came out in the 50s with tobacco, the companies did research, and they found out that it was the nicotine that caused people to smoke. And then they figured out a way to reduce the nicotine. But when Wendy did that, nobody wanted to smoke. I mean, you fire up the stick for nothing. But then they experimented with it to lower the levels of nicotine, and they figured out if you put sugar in it, it would make it sweeter, but it would lower the pH, and it basically freebased the nicotine, go to the brain faster, and people got hooked on it. And they marketed that. And the real deal there was, after all of the research and homework, is these companies, they didn't care. They were hooking a $50,000 fish because it'd be addicted forever until they died, and 400,000 people dying every
year. You know, I don't know if in your terms the jury's still out or not, but there are a lot of people that have switched over to this vaping stuff. And now we've had a law passed here where you've got to be 21 to buy cigarettes in Hawaii, and there's lots and lots of places you can't smoke them, and they're including this other stuff. Just as an interesting observer of law and how things work, do you think that there's a lot of unknowns about that we got to wait a little while to find out how bad that condition or habit is?
Oh, there's no doubt, Mike. It's the body is so complex, and the chemistry of that stuff coming in, they're doing it just for the nicotine again, and it doesn't make sense to get hooked on nicotine. So it's a non-starter. So I'm with the public health officials on that. On the other hand, if someone's trying to quit tobacco, maybe, but for a new smoker, it makes no sense at all.
You know, kidding.
It's just a nicotine delivery device.
Boy, I know we're going to have future programs on this stuff, people. If you got somebody that's vaping, and I can't believe it. To me, I was behind a car the other day, and I thought the car was on fire. There's so much smoke coming out the windows, a couple of kids in there, and it's like they're trying to determine or see who can produce the most vapor. It must kill you. I mean, it's killing me. You must think as an attorney. Wow. One more thing before we go back into this historical thing. A lot of people don't understand this, myself included. Every now and again, and you've represented many people in groups, so where you do like what I guess you guys call a class action thing. Is it good that precedents are set there? In other words, you said with the tobacco, it was very hard for the single smoker to go against big tobacco. But when hundreds of thousands of them got together, you know, things happen. What is class action? What does that mean? And what does it do for an attorney that gets a case later, which may duplicate something that's already happened?
There's lots of different things there. There's about 10 questions you ask in that, what you thought was one.
I'm so excited to finally be able to talk to you about this stuff. That's why.
No. We represented the state of Hawaii as a special attorney general to represent all of the taxpayers in the tobacco. The way that worked, it was really a big, complex commercial claim from the standpoint the tobacco company sold a pack of cigarettes for $5, but the real cost was 10. Where's the other 5? That's for the people who get sick, that don't have insurance, and you and I, taxpayer, paying the money. So it was an equitable theory to come back at the manufacturers to really make them pay their honest share, their fair share, and that's how come that was successful. Most of our cases, oftentimes people think they are class actions, but they're actual individual cases, like the asbestos cases. They have common liability, but depending on the various exposures, different companies, causation can be different, and the different injuries are different. So oftentimes cases that people perceive as class actions are really not. On the other hand, class actions are very expensive to litigate, and it really has to be worthwhile in lots of different ways. So a class action in many ways is only available, or should be available, to where the individual cases aren't big enough to bring by themselves, but when you collect them up, it makes sense.
Now, interestingly enough, I think people need to know the concept behind your firm. Obviously, you know, you're the fire and brimstone guy that you've jumped in all of these challenges, but you've got a whole team that's going to take a look and analyze these things, talk about maybe some of the things that happen typically if your firm decides to take a case, sort of what the mechanics of it are. How do you parse out who needs to do what?
We will look at, you know, we'll look at 5 or 10, maybe even 20 cases for every one we take. I like to get involved in cases where we can involve our whole team, and we have a real powerhouse. Mm-hmm. I have partner, Rick DeRobertis, has been with me for 32 years, a Bolt Hall legal scholar, a medical paralegal, Cynthia Davis, been 32 years, on and on. We have a real brain trust. And so we have those powerful research tools that here in Hawaii we can do, national quality mm-hmm. research and legal work. So I like to align myself with cases that are going to be good for Hawaii, or good mm-hmm. for the people in Hawaii, good for the workers in Hawaii, good for the citizens in Hawaii. And so when we recover, the money is secondary to doing what we mm-hmm. think is the right thing for policy reasons.
But let me tell you something. I'm going to blow your horn a little bit here so you can explain how. Almost everything that happens in Hawaii is because it's happened somewhere else. Somebody was so good at something, they came over here to show us bumpkins in Hawaii what to do. You have been exporting expertise. I mean, you're actually involved in cases as a consultant and hands-on in across the country. How in the heck do you put that into the schedule? Because that means every time you turn around, Gary's on an airplane.
Well, there's a lot of that. There's a lot of jet lag. And if I don't have jet lag, it means I'm not working this week. Mm. No, I travel to the mainland usually once a month, a week, 10 days for our cases. And we have several projects we combine. But with our research weapons or our resources we have in Hawaii and nationally, we can get ahead of the power curve in lots of ways. For instance, I found out about respirators being defective, guys thinking they're protecting themselves.
Yeah, yeah. I heard a little bit about that. So that's really cool, because while you were before working on the end results of maybe somebody not wearing a respirator, what about people that have supreme confidence in this thing that they put on and it's no good?
Oh, that's a tragic part. It's mm-hmm. It's an illusion of safety. Mm-hmm. The guy is wearing a mask. And it may as well be wearing a hockey mask. Yeah. At least you know it's not, because the thing is leaking around the edges through mm-hmm. the side, or even worse. So I've got 15 years of expertise in that, and we're involved in 40 different states consulting on those cases.
Yeah, I think that what happens is maybe people inadvertently are going to get up on their toes and start checking themselves when they find out that somebody's sniffing around in an area that might be very, very expensive. Always people want to know, and I know we don't have enough time in this particular program to explain it, but sometimes when there is monetary or compensation, it seems hard to understand why somebody could get so much money for something. And I've heard you say outside of the program that when you think it's a whole bunch, sometimes it's not even anywhere near enough. I mean, there's no way that you can compensate some loss.
Oh, there's just no way. We represent these poor guys with mesothelioma. They worked a whole life, or some might have only worked a summer job now they're school teachers, or they're working for the IRS or something, and this asbestos reaches out from 50 years ago and causes mm-hmm. mesothelioma. Or we're getting involved in head injuries where, somebody played football, and repetitive brain injuries that are just now being diagnosed. All of those we get involved because of the policy reasons and find a legal remedy that can help the family. And I promise you, there's not one single settlement I've ever gotten for someone that the family wouldn't take it back if they get out.
Yeah, and
their
health
of the person. So it's never is enough, but we do our best, and we have a good reputation nationally.
Yeah, I've seen an awful lot of absolute solid testimonials and people whose lives have changed when they feel desperation. And I do know that many, many cases, and you can explain, you've already said that you can, there's no way you can take all that come your way. But I would imagine that you're going to take somebody that you're not going to be able to take and recommend that they go in another direction, because I guess it's impossible to feed everybody with one loaf, So, I mean, but yet, I'm also guessing that this team approach that you're doing now is bring it. When you find a challenge, you already know the parameters of what you're going to do and what the mechanics of it are going to be like.
Yeah, we do our homework. We really, mm-hmm. really try to do a good job, because we know what's ahead of us and we don't underestimate the risk. But once we've decided that there was something wrong, or a product or was defective, or someone mm-hmm. got injured or tragically hurt as a result of something, it's not a one-off. There's a whole pattern. We figure out that mm-hmm. pattern, and at that point we find out who's on the other side and how it happened. And we don't much care who's on the other side at that point, because we've mm-hmm. done our homework already.
Are you afraid of anybody?
Mike Bach, you might talk. stink about me.
Old,
you know?
I don't mean childhood friend. I mean, is there anything that you'd say, no, that's not for us. I don't think we can handle that. Because I'm looking, saying that, sure, there probably would be some things, but they wouldn't be some things for long. You'd figure out a way to make it work.
We're working now on cases against the NFL and helmet manufacturers, possibly on traumatic brain injuries. And no, if there's a case and it has merit and there's a legal way to recovery, and our team feels good about it, we'll take the case.
Yeah, and by the way, on that subject of concussions and head injuries, I know that we're going to get into that down the road in the program. Very, very real, and it's an individual thing. Not everybody's going to get one. But I think that there's another side that they don't know about you. I remember when we were leading up to doing this program, some of the research that I did and some of the materials that were given to me to look at, we have a tremendous and growing geometrically section of the community of elders, and many, many of these people have some sort of abuse, whether it's physical abuse, mental abuse, or financial abuse, and that's coming across a lot of attorneys' desks more often. You've produced a nice piece on this. You must have a very warm spot in your heart for somebody that's lived the whole life and now somebody's trying to chop them up.
Well, it's not so much that is you want to take care of your parents, especially right. In Hawaii is a real close aloha there, and you try to find the best place for them, and you put your trust in those facilities, and it's shocking that what can happen. The vast majority of people are well taken care of, but there are certain places and things that happen that are just hideous. Mm-hmm. And it's tragic because these people are helpless, absolutely helpless when they're in assisted living and they get hung up in a bed rail overnight and someone doesn't go look for them 7 hours and their whole life has changed. They get trapped in something like that, or they're left and not maintained in soiled conditions. It's tragic. But again, there, we're trying to represent someone that's helpless, that needs help. And the families are strapped and they're working, or you have single parent or trying to take care of her parents or a mother and a father, and they have to go to someplace, and we're just trying to enforce those standards so people are taken care of.
By the way, let me throw in a little semi-commercial. You're going to hear some real commercials down the road, I promise. But today, at least, we're just trying to get to know Gary a little bit more for you. But I do know that you have this nice piece of work that your team put together that you can offer it for free, that all they got to do is go to GallagherLaw.com and send a little inquiry. Talk about how technology, you've had to embrace it over the years. I mean, you got a bunch of young kickers on your team now that really are a little sharper than you and me with the tweeters and the twatters and all of that stuff. But let's talk about how your profession is moving in that direction a little bit.
Oh, no, I've got some really talented, smart people around me. And they're just technically so swift and so quick. They look through tens of thousands of documents and word search them, and all of this stuff is available. Whereas before, I'd manually have to go through 50 banker's boxes of documents, page by page.
Some people out there today are saying, what's a banker's box?
Oh, they don't exactly. Even know that. Exactly.
Is that a zip drive? I mean, what is that?
I saw someone, I talked to someone the other day that said, counterculture. What is that counterculture? Mm-hmm. Wait. You know, that's people, in the 60s. Mm-hmm. But no, it's really changed. It's really exciting. And you're in the middle of it right here. You're on this fancy radio station, recording studio of yours, and there's technology all around. And I'm not quite Barney Rubble, but I'm not the front.
Into your office. You're high tech as they come, but you probably still want to have it referred out. But I guess the bottom line is that I guess it's making us a little bit more aware of the bad part about technology, the cyber crime, and some of the other things that we'll be talking about, going down the street here. But I think too that maybe people understand or got to understand that the concept is you have to put your faith in somebody, and so maybe you could take a minute to explain how important power of attorney is before somebody is allowed to give power of attorney to somebody, that you really ought to think this through.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we're sitting here and you just take your health for granted.
Mm-hmm.
One day you could walk across the street, get run over by a bus or a truck, and, you're hanging by a thread, and you might not want to hang by that thread for 2 years. That's your choice now. So you want to give that decision-making to someone else that you really trust and has good judgment.
Yeah, but what I'm concerned about is that we've seen in the elders, and I did look some of the materials that you put together, that sometimes people will talk somebody out of that strength, that power of attorney, and all of a sudden a family comes along and finds out that mom and dad's stuff is all gone.
No, well, that's, you know, tragedies happen like that, or, you know, we're part of the human condition, and, you know, for ever there have been good people and bad people, but that's where you need the closest people around you to help make those decisions and jointly. And in these different circumstances, we see it all. And a tragedy of mesothelioma where there's no cure, and you end up going all the way through hospice. And I've come to really, really appreciate what a wonderful service that is for that part of people's lives. And families that have been alienated or not talking to each other can sometimes come together. So that's the flip side of what you're talking about.
Yeah, but you know, now you're heading up a team, and you got this whole approach to it. But let's go back a step or two, because, you know, after you worked for the firms that you did, let's talk about when you opened your office and hung out the Gary Gallagher shingle for the first time on your own.
Well, I was fortunate that I had Ray Tam and Walter Kirimitsu that guided me and got me started. I was full of confidence, and I thought I could do these things, which I felt good about, but I had good training. And then once I felt and educated myself well enough on the cases, when I went out on my own, I already had over 100 asbestos cases. Mm-hmm. And we had cases that were set for trial, and I had worked as a carpenter and mortgaged my real estate on the North Shore.
I was going to say, that must have been a couple of tense days back there. You know?
Oh, yeah. There was a lot of people thought I was crazy or knew I was crazy or, you know, depending, whatever. But I just believed in the cases. I believed in myself.
I think the part of the touching part is that I don't know if you're even able to relate that, or even emotionally, if you can relive it, some of the things that... Some of the reasons why you get up the next day to go to work on a case when you've made somebody whole again, whether or not you've gotten them a cash settlement, or you've gotten the medical attention that they need, or you got their family to understand what they're going through. These are some, I think being an attorney, you also got to be kind of a shrink. And that's what kind of you were doing, right?
Well, I must say I'm humbled, or I'm honored to have represented all the wonderful people I have, and now I got a super team around me that can help on these things. Mm-hmm. But it is, when you can help someone and they're astounded at what you can do for them or what their family can do or they're unable to do from your work, it's very fulfilling.
Yeah,
very fulfilling.
What about people that want to follow in the footsteps? I know that they're... you know, you have a young team around you, which is certainly indicative of the fact that you're willing to share your expertise and get people on the ball like you, so that they can help the firm. But there's a lot of people probably saying, "Hey, I can do that. I can. I want to hang. I'm tired of being a law clerk for somebody else. I want to open my own business."
It's a pretty tough sled. Yeah, it's a competitive environment out there, especially on the plaintiff side, representing someone that's been hurt or injured. To do a really, really good job, the insurance companies and the big defendants have so much money and so many resources. They hire the best lawyers to think and buy, per hour, and they're excellent, excellent lawyers on the other side.
Yeah, and that's the other side of it. I mean, I do know that every now and again, because I know Gary, by the way, and that's part of the reason we're doing this program. But I also know that you're already. I've learned just by the cursory look I've taken that this team of yours is non-defeatable, that they just are not going to accept it. And I think that maybe that differentiates a team approach to a guy, a one-man band in an office. They just can't get the amount of work done or be as accurate.
There's some truth to that. By the same token, there's some incredible lawyers in Honolulu that are one-man bands that are tremendous lawyers, but they just have to be more selective in what they take.
What do you think is there a formula? I don't, you know, we can't give away trade secrets, otherwise they'd have to kill me. But I do know that there's the criteria that you must use is not automatically will we win this, but do we believe in it? I mean, how do you determine where to place your energy and your faith?
Well, you have to do a lot of homework. You have to factually understand what really happened, what the circumstance is. And, for instance, with respect to a defective product, whether it's a lawnmower that rolled over and killed someone or an asbestos product, when you find something wrong with a product, it's rare that it's unique.
Mm-hmm.
It's usually a pattern. And who's the expert on that? It's the manufacturer. So you do a lot of research and digging, and lo and behold, we're not the Lone Ranger. Something happened before. Someone got hung up in this brand of bed rail that's made it defective, or in the asbestos. They knew about it. Their own workers were getting sick. So you just got to do a lot of work and then get on solid ground legally. And so I got the smartest lawyers working with me.
You know, I do that research.
They make me look really good.
Yeah, I know that. but you're being humble because it's the research that you instruct them to do that makes them effective. But I was thinking about you the other day because I'm driving down the street and I heard one of the many, many stories about this airbag company that is like up the creek with problems with millions of these things. How in the world does industry get along with doing something so bad for so long before they get found out?
That's really tough because they knew about that. The engineers knew about that, and somebody, you know, in the Japanese company told somebody, but they wouldn't fix it because it cost, you know, a few cents extra or a buck extra or some number like that. And what's the chances of the airbag going off?
Yeah.
And the most extreme.
That's great. Well, you know, roll the dice. What do you feel
like?
That's
it. And they've gone. There's some companies that actually have, they call them bean counter memos. Mm. They will have an actuary come in and figure out there's going to be, you know, how many accidents, how many people are going to die, when should have, what's the chances of this failing?
Right.
And we got to pay, you know, $1 million or $5 million or $10 million on this, but we're only going to have 3 cases. We're better off taking rolling the dice. Mm-hmm. And then some governmental agency in the United States really does their homework, and it's usually led by a plaintiff's lawyer that did all this doing.
Usually runs that lead. I mean, it's got to
see, that's where the policy is. You know, people, oh, lawyers, blah, 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 blah. But you know what? It really changes. The tobacco usage went down because of the tobacco litigation. Asbestos products got safer or eliminated, largely eliminated asbestos. Every defective product, when it gets fixed, helps us all in the long run.
What I get afraid about is now that I've known what you've been involved in, and I see some of these other things like these airbags and high chair, kids' high chair that's going to pinch Cyril Coley or whatever, it's got to get taken back. Is what's lurking out there with all of this new stuff that they're coming up with? Case in point is, I think it's a question rather than a statement. I watch TV at night and I see some medicine being advertised, and it says, "Hey, this is going to cure your headaches, man." And then about 30 seconds, they're going to tell you all the ways that same pill is going to kill you. Is that because they're trying to rush a thing out on the market right away, or they're just trying to cover their, you know what's, in case somebody does get sick because of their medicine? Isn't that a huge area of concern?
It's huge.
Yeah,
it's huge. You know, you hit the nail on the head. Big Pharma's got so much money, and they know how to market to a T. They have incentives for the scientists to come up with it. And they figure out how to market it to where the patients are seeing it on TV and going asking their doctor for it.
Yeah.
The doctor doesn't even know about it.
Yeah, of course. Interesting. Yeah.
And then, but again, when the products come out and they start, you know, like Fosamax, that was for bones to keep them from getting brittle. Well, it did just the opposite. It made them more brittle.
Oh, boy.
And so
The digging, Gary? Here's the thing. We already know that these things are happening. And is it the same thing? They're rolling the dice, these big farm companies saying, look, some people are going to get sick. We're going to have to pay out some settlements, but most people aren't. It's going to help a lot of people. Let's go ahead and make this stuff.
But it's not rolling the dice. They're just making money.
Mm-hmm.
And that for them, it's incidental roadkill and the tragic ones. And it's tragic. And oftentimes, the side effects can be minor. Well, you know, you get a stomach ache, that's one thing. But, you know, if it starts a hemorrhage or it causes some devastating problem or affects your kidneys or something downstream, it's tragic when that happens. And unfortunately, those are the hardest ones to litigate because oftentimes they get MDL'd, meaning multi-district litigation, even though we bring it in Hawaii. It's going to get removed to federal court and then go someplace up on the mainland.
Mm-hmm.
and that there's it's just a crude approximation of justice.
That's got to be hard to for a firm too to decide. All right, this is going to take us on the road. I mean, we're going to have to do an awful lot of miles of this. Can we be reasonably certain that we can have that in our other caseload? Like, let's talk about maybe some of the things that you can talk about. Some of the cases that you're working on today. What sort of day to day activity is Gallagher going through?
My day to day involved cases we were involved with for the last 15 years. Mm-hmm. I discovered a fraud on the court, an insurance company was involved. We're still litigating that. I'm involved with cases looking at a chronic traumatic encephalopathy, which is the brain injury from getting hit in the head, mm-hmm. playing football too much. And it's really not the football, it's really the helmet that's causing it, because all the helmets did was weaponize the brain.
I was going to say, didn't that just contain the damage?
It didn't. Yeah. You look at those helmets, and it looked like it would protect your brain, but when you see what those players do to one another, it's impossible to protect the most delicate organ that ever evolved to in a helmet, a head-on-head collision.
We've all seen the long-term effect of some of that on some of the players, particularly some of these guys. Like, I'll never forget the pictures that I saw of the late Raider, Lyle Alzado, when this guy was just physically, mentally just hammered from his thing, but he couldn't give it up. He was an alpha male, and he wanted to do that, and he was getting paid a lot of money. Gary, I'm worried right now that some of these players are getting so much money, I mean so much money, that they're hiding or masking the damage that's going on with them because they just don't want to not play.
Oh, I'm sure there's some of that going on. You see in younger players that are making better decisions on that, but the real crime that went on there was the NFL, that's their business model. They suppressed the science on showed long-term neurocognitive decline because of repetitive head injuries. Yeah. They said, no, when in fact it was going on. And that it's tragic because it's going on now. We represent some NFL players. Mm-hmm. And as it goes on now, and for every NFL player, there's hundreds or thousands or nationally millions of young kids that are playing that have had every time the head is concussed or even subconcussion, it causes a cascade of things to come down and change the brain. And it's not as severe as someone who's drooling or look like they're 70 when they're only 35, mm-hmm. but it's moving into that
you
direction.
You know, it's interesting because I'm waiting for something to happen to me. I broke everything. I knocked out teeth playing football. I got concussioned a couple of times. And I'm guessing that in all probability I'm atypical, that everybody that played this sport is somehow affected by it, if they played seriously, if they played long enough.
It's a continuum, a gradient. If it starts at zero and the more you play, the higher mm-hmm. the risk, and to where it's undeniable. If you have Muhammad Ali, there's not much question there. And it's the same thing. It's just the more extreme, and the longer they play, the more impact, the more damage to the brain. And with that CTE, chronic traumatic encephalopathy, which is a traumatic brain injury, nothing else causes that. Mm-hmm. And it's diagnosed, but now it takes pathology. They look at the brain after somebody died.
I, from what I understand, there's actually been new procedures and scans and other studies developed that help determine just how bad off you are. I think what's sort of ironic is somebody said the other day on my other regular radio show, well, that's why my kid plays soccer. I don't want him to play football because, football is bad for you. But I'm looking at a kid playing soccer. He didn't even got a helmet on. So how deep a look do we have to take at some other sports as to see, wouldn't it be just about anything with contact? Wouldn't basketball be the same thing?
We're fortunate in Hawaii that where our athletic directors here and research team out of H-Camp is doing original research that's looking at all the other sports. What we want is just transparency. Mm-hmm. We want to save the sports. We just want to make it more safer. If you compare rugby to football, the amount of concussions in rugby is real small. Mm-hmm. By a mountain over here, a Mount Everest, what's the difference? tackling and the helmet.
Yeah.
The helmet is what actually
causes. Something about the helmet, because the helmet used to be leading with the helmet.
The kids go run, pound each other, and, you know, it's got to change, and we're trying to educate and trying to work with trainers and be in the vanguard nationally. I mean, Hawaii is in the lead there.
And is it because we're 24/7 outside? I mean, are we just playing more stuff than some of these mainland kids do?
No, as far as the research, the UH and H camp, you know, they found out, for instance, the highest rate of concussions when they first studied was Wahine judo.
Wow.
19 times higher than other. Well, it turns out the Wahine brain is different. Different skull, different, and how it moves inside, and they're more susceptible. So Wahine basketball, and the same with soccer. But the soccer, interesting on the research there, the hitting of the ball, the concussions more frequently occur when two players hit.
I was going to say head-to-head, right?
Not so much the ball. I'm not. But what we want to do is get accelerometers in all sports to where there's just data. We can generate it, and we can subtly change the rules to make it safer.
Isn't
we
that really how technology where it's
exactly. So that's help. What we're trying to. We're trying to embrace technology, and Hawaii's really in a wonderful spot right there. And the University of Hawaii is leading the way in H camp.
What I'm worried about a lot now is, you know, we're our kids are being told and pounded in school. You got to go to college. You got to get an education if you want to make it. You got to do this. How many parents are encouraging a kid to play a sport to augment the cost of going to school? And in Hawaii, particularly, when almost everything is going to be out of state, cost big money, how many of our kids are maybe playing a little bit too hard and be becoming susceptible?
That's a complex question. That's a tough question for parents and players and coaches. But that's where we want to move into this and just get full disclosure because, for instance, if we just played football with helmets and practice not in springtime, and cut it back to 2 days a week. Mm-hmm. We would cut the concussions probably in half.
Yeah.
So, no, that's where
there's
we
have. There's no money in that. How many helmets can I sell, and how many pads do I need
well,
to do?
I think Hawaii is going to lead the way for the right reasons and make the right decisions. So we're trying to help on that front, too.
Okay, so that being said, let's talk a little bit more about the team and more or less the values of it. You have the best of the brightest coming to you. What criteria, what sort of measuring stick do you use to determine if somebody's going to be able to come in and be a part of your team?
A lot of people don't want to be part of the team because it takes a lot of work. Mm-hmm. And
well, they thought it was going to be easy. You can tell them that story.
No. They come around, they hang around, they see, and they see the toll it takes on me and what I have to do the things we do. By the same token, I'm in it. I felt sorry for the people that we started out with, and we got a solid vehicle now. People have the same kind of values, are not afraid to work hard, mm-hmm. and they love the esprit de corps we have in the firm. And they love – I've had lawyers come to me from the defense side, and it's so much more rewarding on our side. Mm-hmm. Even though the talented defense lawyers that get paid by the hour, for what? You know, I mean, they do a good job for the client, but at the end of the day – we get close to our families. Mm-hmm. We get close.
I was going to say, at the end of the day, when somebody comes up and gives you a hug or a wink or a smile, that doesn't maybe happen in other branches quite as often. No, I would imagine. I want to know too. I want people to understand that you know when you came over here as a youngster to surf, you also planted seeds here. And if anybody knows the difficulty of travel and traffic, it is you. Your primary residence on another island. You're back and forth in an airplane and a helicopter, and I think that maybe a lot of people are wondering, how does this guy do time management? Let's put aside the Gallagher Law Firm for a minute and talk about how you manage time.
That would be my short suit. I'm here today in your office, and I wish I was in Molokai.
Yeah, of course.
But I'm going tomorrow. I'm going tomorrow.
Well, let's build a studio over there, and then I'll have
the excuse. I think you're about as inclined to retire as I am, so maybe we'll have, you know, one day a week over there. That would be a nice idea.
I'm retiring probably in maybe 2090. I'm not sure. You know?
I've actually picked the day I'm going to retire. It's the day they pat my face with a shovel. Yeah. I'm not working anymore, I promise.
But, you know, that's another thing. It's interesting, I think, you know, the 38, 39 years in the business, certainly has given you a wide myriad of things to look at. I think that maybe, and believe me, I'm not asking you about your bucket list yet, because then I'd have to give you mine, and I'm not willing to do that yet either. But I know you want to make a mark. Someday you're going to want to say, oh, that Gallagher guy, he was a good guy because. What's going to drive that bus, do you think, down the road?
I don't think that way. We've done various things. I got a reading program I sponsor on Molokai. That's about as ambitious as I can get. We help with, my daughter had leukemia as a survivor. Wonderful medical resources here in Hawaii and the cancer research. But I just take great pride in representing our clients well.
We are having a resurgence of a lot of things in Hawaii that you and I have become aware of now. We have a lot more, I want to say, understanding of what maybe the native Hawaiian population expects from the non-Hawaiians and what the non-Hawaiians expect of the Hawaiians. And all of these things are ending up somehow in court. I think that people need to understand that this thing called court and these people called lawyers are not such a bad thing. When you have a problem, that they are really the to be able to triage and do that. So once again, returning to the kind of cases that make you feel the way you want to feel. You know, obviously, I don't want to say personal injury, but this sort of the genre of cases that you follow means that if I get a speeding ticket, don't call Gary Gallagher.
No, I can't help you on that, but there's a lot of good lawyers who can.
Yeah.
And, you know, they've done a lot of work, either the prosecutors or the public defenders, and they know their way around district court extremely well. And, you know, those are the kind of lawyers we all need to go ask around and who's got a good reputation and find them.
I know a lot of people, their first two questions are, how much is it and how long is it going to take? Do people have to develop a little bit of understanding about this thing called law and the process of courts and lawsuits and litigation?
Well, it's complex, and it's, you know, it's easy to talk stink about lawyers, but when you need one, you want to get the best one you can get.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it's like when you
He's a son of a gun. Good, get his number. I might need him.
Yeah, it's like if you need the neurosurgeon, the brain surgeon, you don't want the best deal you can get. You want the best surgeon you can get. By the same token, you know, we have so much in Hawaii to be thankful for, and I've just prided myself in bringing the best legal services we can on cases that tend to have a national side to them, but bring that high-caliber legal work to Hawaii.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I sort of was guessing that, because I do know in the last several months that we've played tag a lot because of the travel commitments that you do have to make. And I do know that that's a really big part of it, but I still think that the ability to have a model from Hawaii go somewhere else is the most impressive thing. This tobacco thing, one question that was lingering, I meant to ask you when we were talking about that a while ago. Some states they give subsidies to people that grow tobacco. I mean, you know, aren't we kind of double standard here that a real cost of a pack of cigarettes to the cigarette company might be $2, but it's 10 when you go to the gas station? There's a lot of bites out there. There's a lot of people taking a bite.
Oh, yeah. And that one is, you know, as far as a business model, you know, morals and ethics aside, you know, what's better? Cost a penny to make and you sell it for $1, you know? Mm-hmm. Better than that, they're addicted. They have to have it. Mm-hmm. So, unfortunately, the politics of it historically were not pretty. The AMA, American Medical Association, worked with the tobacco farmers and senators in the South to protect the product mm-hmm. for years. But all that's history, and we have to learn, and the human condition is complex. But the law plays a very, very important role. And we need to use the legal services judiciously, but we should be very proud in Hawaii for what we have, the legal services. And there's a lot of work to be done. C.J. Richardson, the last time I actually talked to him, was at an award ceremony for the William S. Richardson School of Law, and I told him, I said, I was so thankful to him mm-hmm. that he started the law school, because that's where I went.
But for the grace of God goes Gary Gallagher, right?
Well, not only that, but he turned it around and magnified it 1,000 times.
Gary, you came out of that early in the piece. It wasn't a big, high reputation. I mean, it wasn't a totally accepted and grasped. And now, I'm happy to say quite the opposite. I mean, look at the number of people that we're sending to Washington, D.C. as politicians. Look at some of the people that are products of that school that got as good an education as someone can get.
No, I agree wholeheartedly. And the theory was, or the premise of it was, there were a lot of local kids that couldn't go to school and the mainland couldn't afford it. And so when I made that comment to CJ while he was still alive, he said, Gary, law school is the best thing I ever did. He was so excited about it. And it was like the gift that kept giving intellectually and giving back to the state. So he was so rightfully proud of that creation.
I'm back to this other thing, because so excited to be able to talk to you and talk story about some of my experiences and how, you know, how law bounces off. And I'm behind a guy the other day at the gas station out in Hawaii Kai on my way in at 4:30 in the morning, getting my cup of coffee and my little crumpet for breakfast. And this guy buys a energy drink and a couple of packs of cigarettes, and it's like $30. And I'm thinking, you're $30 down, the sun's not even up. When are people going to wake up, not just about the health, but about the expense of that habit? It's expensive to smoke some cigarettes.
Mike, you're this again, this is just the human condition. I can't solve all problems. I can't answer even some of those. But the energy drink and the caffeine in there, and, you know, I love caffeine. I have my caffeine in the morning.
Yeah, you and me both. I'm a morning caffeine guy.
I'm weaning myself off Diet Cokes and those things, because the research recently is not so good for the body. Mm. But I love coffee in the morning. Mm-hmm. So I'm not quite like your guy. And I certainly don't have the cigarettes. And I brew my own coffee in the morning, except when I'm really high rolling, I'll go to Starbucks.
Gary, I think that people need to know, though, the success that you had on behalf of the state and the tobacco settlement. I remember when I was still in denial about maybe smoking being bad for you. And I smoked, and I paid no attention, even when the warnings first came out. And then back in the days, it was, hey, you know, if you do these things, there's some kind of possibility that you might get sick someday. And now it's like, if you smoke these, you're going to die. There's been a big change in the Surgeon General and everybody else's look on this. Do people think that, okay, it's not going to happen to me? I mean, look at how many patients that you've probably seen that had no clue that they're going to die now. It's just a matter of time.
Well, I mean, that's what's the hallmark of addiction. It's what's the number one symptom of addiction? It's denial.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't matter what it is, whether it's drugs, it's alcohol, it's tobacco. Addiction is addiction. It reformats the brain's reward pathways, and there it goes. Mm-hmm. And you're going to want that. You're going to want that fix. And so, you know, people really, really underestimate how addictive cigarette smoking is. And, you know, I think there's statistics that would back up that heroin is easier to quit than tobacco.
You know, I just thought about something else. And in any number of the cases that you deal with, I'm supposing, particularly in the asbestos area and tobacco area, we got double whammies going. We got a guy that's a contractor or working in a factory or in a shipyard, and he's smoking cigarettes all his life. He's breathing in asbestos all his life. He's doing all kinds of other fumes all his life, so that basically his life is shortened by the fact that he's doing what he's doing. So how do you differentiate what really is hurting the guy? Or is it everything?
I know it's a complex question, but it depends on the facts of the individual case. If someone quit smoking 20 years ago, their risk of getting a lung cancer comes all the way down to almost that of a non-smoker. Mesothelioma, yeah, which was a cancer of the lining or the outside of the lung, is not related to smoking at all.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't matter if you smoked or didn't smoke. Okay. You're still just as likely. When you're trying to sort out between cigarette smoking and lung cancer,
what's getting you, right?
Asbestos makes some fingerprints in the lungs that can be diagnosed on X-ray, a diffuse interstitial fibrosis, a scarring of the lungs, or some what we call asbestos markers, or if there's a surgery and lung tissue is available, it can diagnose that type of scarring in the lung tissue, or if there's enough raw lung tissue available from pathology department, like if a lung part of one is removed, we actually do analysis of that, and they find asbestos in there.
Yep.
Well, that's pretty good evidence.
Okay, let me ask you something. Did you have any fun today?
I had a great time.
Because an hour's gone. You know that?
We've been I thought you were talking about this morning. I was paddling around. Alamona Park.
I just want to know the last 55 minutes if you've had a good time.
Oh, no.
I want to tell you, this has been a joy for me to introduce you to our audience, and I just hope that people realize that there's a big team of folks working at Gallagher Law, and that your door's open. You'll talk to folks.
You know, Mike, you've been after me for months or better part of a year, or maybe more than a year to get this started. And I must admit, I'm looking forward to working with you.
I have the patience of Job. Who is that? Not the cigarette guy. That's the rolling papers guy. That's not that guy.
No, that's not the Mike Buck. I know. You never fool a patience, the guy. I know. His hair is on fire. He does everything.
Hey, listen, gang, if you want to know a little bit more about the scope and breadth of what's happening at the Gallagher Law Firm, you just got to go to GallagherLaw.com. That's G-A-L-I-G-H-E-R, Gallagher, Gallagher.com.
That was close.
You only said Gallagher once.
No, but you spelled it wrong.
Yeah, G-A-L-I-H-E-R, how's that? And by the way, here's a pro to tell you the same thing.
Well, that's our program for today, and we certainly hope you'll come back next week for our next episode. In the meanwhile, to learn more about Team Gallagher, log on to GallagherLaw.com. That's G-A-L-I-H-E-R, law.com.